June 14, 1974, Oral History Project Number 2, Pittsburgh Section, National Council of Jewish Women, interviewing Mr. Leon Falk in his office at the Grant Building, 33rd floor, being interviewed by Minnie Sussman and Corinne Stress. It's Corinne Kress. Leon, you were talking very informally about the role that your father and you played in being a bridge between the Jewish community and the non-Jewish community in a very unique fashion. I wonder if you would mind repeating what you started to tell us.
Well, I started to tell you about my father's relationship and his friends that many of the leading Jewish families were connected with heavy industry put them automatically in contact with their counterparts in the Christian community. And family like the I.W. Frank family, our family, there were a number of them in the scrap business that they had contacts with the heavy industry.
Can I interrupt just for a minute? What year did your family start?
Beg pardon?
What year did your family start in heavy industry?
Oh, I guess it was before the turn of the century.
Uh-huh.
Our family, as near as I can see, came over right after the Civil War.
From where?
Germany. And my mother's family went to the South after the Civil War. And my mother went to college in Richmond, and that's where she and my father met.
It was unusual for that generation, wasn't it, to go to college? Wasn't it unusual for that generation to go to college?
I don't know.
Okay, but then you were talking about that.
As far as my father went to WJ, and Uncle Morris never went to college. He was too busy working. But this well-known association, contact and business carried over into other fields at the same time. And there was a group of Jewish leaders that were very close to the top Christian leaders in Pittsburgh.
Who were they?
Well, it was like I.W. Frank. I'd have to think of all of them. What was his name? Aaron?
Mark, was that Marcus Aaron?
Marcus Aaron was very close to him. My father and uncle, who became associated with Mr. Weir and Eddie Mudge and, mm-hmm. and those people. And must be more. I'd have to, I haven't thought the names through, you know, but there was quite a little group of them.
I was wondering if, yeah.
Then, as far as the merchants went, they had a second kind of relationship. I mean, the Kaufmans, for example, were wealthy, and when there was a charitable thing, they were asked. But they didn't have the same kind of a contact that when you're a partner in a business. Now, that developed later. Edgar had it later on, but the original founders of Kaufmans did not have that same contact.
I think you've opened up so many areas, Leon, just in those few things, that I wondered, as you said, you couldn't remember offhand, that perhaps if you thought about some of these things, and then we could pick them up later.
I really think if you're thinking about, you know, the kind of relationship, maybe you could tell us.
Well, that followed, that there was a complete break at one point. Now it's starting to come back again.
What caused the break?
And just there wasn't any contact. The only contact was through the, maybe the United Fund, which was the community chest in those days. But outside of that contact, there wasn't any. The Jewish community was living a double life. It would go to work in the morning and then it'd have a different life at home in the evening. Dr. Levy used to talk about that.
That's right.
They lived in their own little ghetto as far as their social life went. And we talked about it. Lou Kaplan and I used to talk about it a lot. We set up this study in the old Morris and Laura Falk Foundation of prejudice in the executive suite. I don't know if you're
sure,
familiar
I'm
with
very
that.
Active in that.
Yeah.
Is that on file?
Oh, sure, those studies. That was done by the American Jewish Committee. Mm-hmm. And it got tremendous publicity. And I think as a result of that, a good many of the barriers started to come down. See, I know the Duquesne Club was opened up, I think, as much on that as anything else.
I didn't realize that you were instrumental in beginning that. They're still working.
Now there's a number of members in the Duquesne Club that are Jewish.
But when you started out, and when there was the close contact between those of you, your family, who were in heavy industry, did you feel social barriers, or were you?
Well, we were always invited to the parties, and it was vice versa. I'm going to have the Simpsons tonight to a party.
Mm-hmm.
So that and that goes back. My relationship there goes back to my father's with the past generation. So that those things gradually develop. I think we have in Pittsburgh a pretty good relationship these days with the Christian community.
There don't seem to be any barriers. Do you think it's now more a respect for the individual and what the individual himself is, and
it
has nothing to do with it?
I wouldn't say there wasn't prejudice, because I know there is, but it's different. See.
Well, when
you tell us what it was like in the days when you were one of the few that had these contacts.
Well, I'm never particularly conscious of it. See, there was one thing which I wouldn't want reported.
You were started to talk about attitudes and the Longview Country Club. I wonder if you would mind repeating what you just said in relationship to the origin of the Longview Country
Well,
Club.
Well, that was started on a piece of property that was very close to the Westmoreland Country Club. And in those days, many of the friends of both I.W. Frank and the Falk family were members of Westmoreland and used to play there. And they, at the starting of the club, invited a number of the Westmoreland members to be members at Longview, but told them that they didn't want the whole Westmoreland proposed. The result was that families who had been approached decided maybe it'd be better if they didn't join.
Leon, where did you live as a child? I mean, where was
Atlantic
your...
Atlantic Avenue.
Atlantic? Oh, out there in the East
there.
End.
Yeah.
Oh, really? Well, who were some of your neighbors?
Well, we had a very mixed neighborhood then that was part of the Jewish community there. The Kahn family was there. Lewin family were there. Let's see some of the others. Those were the two that were nearest us. And then there was McDonald's, where we were close with the Jennings. And, it was a very pleasant mixed community. And everybody mingled with everybody else.
What do you think caused the change, you know, when the mingling stopped? And
I don't know how much Hitler had to do with it. There was certainly propaganda and maybe more withdrawal on the part of the Jews than there was on the feeling on the part of the Christians. And the fact that there wasn't that contact anymore.
There wasn't the natural day-to-day business.
Yeah.
Well, weren't you still in the steel business at that time? Of course, there weren't too many of the steel masters at that time.
I was a kid then.
The family was. Yeah, and so there weren't too many around at that time to continue, because management had changed on the parts of the other corporations.
That's right. And it was just a break in contact.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that maybe that was too different in some other cities.
I should imagine that did occur. But you never broke contact, did you?
No, because I was always involved. See, I was put right on the Edgewater Steel Board when Uncle Morris died. I was put on the National Steel Board. I was on these boards.
That is the difference. That's the unique position that you have had.
Because of family connection. It wasn't because I was brilliant at steel. It was because we had a substantial interest, and my father's friends had been accustomed to me, and they just invited me on.
Did you have much training for the steel business?
I did for non-ferrous metal business, yeah. And for the last years that Uncle Morris was on, I did the whole thing.
Had you received some education in
sure,
that?
I worked down at Weirton for years.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So,
but in the mill or
in the mill.
As well as in the office?
Yeah. Old John Williams, who was a Welshman, he believes that the only way you can tell a man how to do a job is to try it yourself.
Right.
And they put you right through. See, and I did practically all the jobs.
How old were you when you started?
I used to spend all my summers down there when I was in school.
Where'd you go to school?
Well, I was at Exeter and Yale.
When your summer's in the mill, that's really interesting.
Leon, how did your working colleagues treat you? I mean, were you the boss's son, that they keep you at arm's length?
Where at?
In the mills.
No.
You were one of them?
You're just one of them, sure. I lived down there, and I lived in a boarding house where a lot of the workers were. I was just one of them.
Oh, that's marvelous. Oh,
that was before there were unions.
Oh,
and they
I
never
think
did unionize working, you know.
Oh, I think that's simply marvelous. Were there any incidents that particularly stand out in your mind as you think back to those days in the mills?
Not particularly.
What, was just pure drudgery, or
no,
was it
fun?
No, fun.
I loved it.
Tell me about your relationships with the workers. I'm asking because my son's working on a construction gang. If he comes home excited every day.
Yeah, there's really, if you do your share, they don't pay any attention to you. Except you become one of them, that's all you see. Now, my kids have all worked down at Weirton, and they insisted on carrying a bucket and sitting there and having lunch with the boys and being treated no different either. So that's pretty standard. There's nothing exceptional about that.
As long as you're doing the same thing.
Yeah.
But I think it's, I'm not going to voice an opinion. Would you say that what you're doing with your boys and they're working in the mills, that this is pretty standard, or today's family sort of treating, well, they want their children to start where the parent currently is? Would you say what you're doing is with your boys is a little bit different?
I would say they're much better able to do a job. They do all the jobs. That was the philosophy then. It's good today, too.
Mm-hmm.
You ask a man to do something, you have to do it yourself first. You know how to ask him.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And he's more willing to
You don't ask the impossible. A hotel, I've made beds, but that's a different thing. My wife has.
Really, has she?
Sure, during the strike, she was over there making beds when Chatham had the big strike. She came back. This isn't running, is it? She came back one day.
Just to get sort of a general kind of a thing now, because you're giving us so much that we're going to have to do some thinking too. But, I mean, one thing leads to another. What are the various interests and enterprises that you are involved in? All right, you just mentioned Chatham Center, and you mentioned steel. What all are you into?
Well, I'll show you one interest.
Yeah, sure.
Alcoa. I got this from him this morning.
May I read the letter?
Yeah. Don't involve that.
Yeah, well, the thing
all
is
right.
this. This is from John Harper of Aluminum Company of America. John Harper's chairman of the board. Dear Leon, I'm attaching a copy of our company publication, the Alcoa News, and another publication, Appalachia, which have stories about Wiley Center Industries. I thought you would be interested in these because of your particular involvement with Wiley Center, starting at the time you brought Clyde Jackson to see me a few years ago. Now, what is Wiley Center and who is Clyde Jackson?
Wiley Center is a little black mill that makes aluminum nails.
Oh. Located where?
It's in Pittsburgh here. Oh. It's on Penn Avenue. And I took Clyde. You know who Clyde Jackson is?
No, I think I've seen his name. I'm not certain.
He's the head of the Black Front.
Oh, right. Sure.
And he and another fellow were dressed up in African dress, and I took them up to John Harper and Al Cohen. You ought to see them look.
Oh, my.
Westinghouse has started a little plant in Homewood, and they wanted something down for the Hill District, and so I figured on Alcoa. Here's a picture of the plant. See, it's all black.
Oh, isn't that something?
And,
you mean, and through your introducing Clyde Jackson to John
and then
Harper.
They decided this would be a good venture for Alcoa to show their interest in the blacks. And it took them a little while to figure out where to put them in the business. They put them in the nail business, and they got the equipment for them and put trainees in to train them, and they got the loans through the PNB, which the federal government backs for these small industries. I'm on the board of it.
Oh, I think that's marvelous.
There they are.
Oh, I think that's wonderful.
Oh, what a beautiful publication.
Leon,
and there's Appalachia. They're on the cover there.
Tell us about Appalachia.
Beg pardon?
What is the connection with your connection with Appalachia?
With it isn't any except that they're writing up the Wiley industry, and John Harper just sent these over this morning.
Do you think we might be able to get some copies of these so that we could include these with your file?
I guess so. Let me read them first. Just came.
Yeah.
Just came in this morning.
We'll give you a chance.
You know, this is so tremendous. One doesn't know really where to start with you or where to end.
I'll tell you one other thing we'll definitely bring up whenever you wish to talk about it, is your involvement with and your work in the civil rights and in the black.
Well, you see, we've been doing that with the medical fund now. We've decided that
Maurice Falk.
Maurice Falk Medical Fund. Mm-hmm. We've decided that prejudice was a mental disease. That why should you dislike a person because he had black skin or because he was Jewish? And we've been spending most of our funds working on that particular angle in mental health.
That's
marvelous.
And we're beginning to show a lot of things. And that's how I met Clyde Jackson and got involved there. But I think that if you sat down with Phil Hallett, you'd find out a lot of what we're doing there. We're involved there all over. We're just giving some scholarships to Yale to bring black students in the medical school there. We've been doing that for some time. We're going to phase that out now.
You did that with Jewish students at Pitt, didn't you?
Yeah, we've done it with black students at Pitt, too.
And I mean, in the days before.
Yeah.
Yes,
we did that. But we've been taking high school kids at Pitt and getting them summer jobs in the medical school and the laboratories, which we pay for. Mm-hmm. And then getting them exposed to the doctors there and then following them through till they apply to medical school and get them ready for it, see.
Okay.
We don't particularly believe that you ought to have a quota system. You ought to get in on merit. And to get the blacks on an equal basis, you have to start with them in high school and get them brought up. And then they can compete, see. But just saying they ought to have so many blacks keeps some white people out that would make maybe better doctors.
Ideas keep coming to my mind. Just interested. You have been involved in so many things, and the Morris Falk Foundation, in addition to what they're doing now with the blacks, but you've been plowing new fields since their inception. How did you do it, and what were some of the kinds of things that were done?
Well, we always felt that foundation funds shouldn't be given for current charities. They ought to be the risk giving. And if you give the risk giving, you go into new fields and try to get something started, and then let the regular contributors pick it up, the society pick it up, if you want to put it that way. So we've had a tradition of always looking for a new field to get into. Now, we had a board on the old Morris and Laura Falk Foundation that was Uncle Morris's friends. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Bell was on it. E.T. Weir was on it. Arthur Braun, who used to be head of the Farmers Bank, was on it. And then there was a group of Jewish members on it. Gene Strasburger was on it. And they would come in with all kinds of questions. Mr. Weir in the 30s came in one day with the question, how could we have such prosperity in 29, and where's all the money gone in the crash? And the result was we went into economic research. We were maybe one of the first foundations that went into it. And we went down to Brookings Institute, which had gone into it, and met a man by the name of Moulton, who was the head of it. And he was a dynamic person. And the first grants we made produced two books, which turned America around to this extent.
Really?
One of them was called America's Capacity to Produce, and the next, America's Capacity to Consume. It was very simple arithmetic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You put those two together, and after we did that, a lot of foundations flocked into it.
But these were the first.
We were one of the first. Brookings was ahead of us. Mm-hmm. There was a setup that had been given by Brookings for economic research. But we were one of the first. Then the Sloan Foundation went into it. Everybody got in.
Was J. Steele Gow your first director?
He was the only one.
He was the only one.
All the way through the 35 years.
Isn't that?
See, Uncle Morris wanted the foundation to terminate. He said, I appointed a board that I know. I don't know who the next board will be. And that went back pretty much to Rosenwald in Chicago, who did the same thing, and he was impressed by it.
Mm-hmm.
And then about 10 years before he died, he thought, maybe you can come up with something that'll be a continuation. That's why we started the medical fund.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's when Phil Hallam came.
That's Phil Hallam.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But we're trying to carry out the same tradition, see, mm-hmm. of looking at new fields. And we felt the toughest thing was mental health.
Mm-hmm.
And involving that with racial hatreds made a pretty interesting project.
That's very interesting. And now it's gotten even farther. I think you've expressed an interest.
Listen, if you'll take this off the record.